I'm Ross Reynolds, and this is The Record. Today, Seattle reacts to Ferguson. What are your thoughts on the grand jury decision to not prosecute the police officer who shot and killed Michael Brown? Could it happen here? Has it happened here? We've got open lines at 206-543-5869. Share your thoughts with us. It's a toll-free number if you're outside the area, 800-289-5869. You can also write to us, record@kuow.org. KUOW social media producer Brian Huberman is with me. How can people join us on social media this afternoon?
Thanks, Ross. They can tweet at KUOW or use our hashtag KUOW Record. Also, they can write to us on our Facebook page, which is KOW Public Radio. For example, we've already heard from Sarah on Facebook who commented, "I'm just numb that these stories stay the same and the outcome doesn't change. We've continued to send a resounding message to young men of color that they just don't matter."
We're trying to have a conversation today, perhaps amplifying and reflecting some of the conversations you've had since last night's decision. Following last night's rioting and looting in Ferguson, this morning, clergy and others blocked morning traffic in the St. Louis suburb where the Ferguson grand jury decision was announced. About 100 demonstrators assembled in downtown Clayton, Missouri, shortly after sunrise and spent several hours blocking intersections, singing spirituals and chanting, "This is what theology looks like." Police monitored the demonstration, one of many planned for today in the St. Louis area. At this hour, there's a march getting underway in Seattle, and in a few moments, Liz Jones will tell us how it's going. But first, we've already heard from some of you about your reactions to what happened in Ferguson and the grand jury decision.
I find this decision heartbreaking and tragic and so maddening. The usual patter comes after the decision was announced about how police forces must be better trained and blah, 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 blah. But you know, you can't train out racism.
I was horrified when I heard that our mayor had enough bad judgment to call the death of Michael Brown a murder. I won't vote for him again, and I'll actively vote to put someone else in. It's that kind of rhetoric at that kind of level that makes this an impossible situation. And he's not a child. At 18 and however many hundreds of pounds he was a man. He stole from somebody and wouldn't do what the police said. What does anybody expect?
The only difference in Seattle, what happened in Ferguson, is that you don't see it bluntly out in public. But it's not saying that it's not there in the shadows. Sometimes that's worse, being in the shadows than it is being in public. The only difference between Seattle and Ferguson really is the quiet, the way that racism is applied to certain people.
That was Brenda from West Seattle, Joe from Shoreline, and James from Seattle. We're taking your phone calls today on The Record. It's 206-543-5869, toll-free long distance 1-800-289-5869, or you can write to record@kuow.org. And we're also getting some feedback on our social media channels. Bond, what are people saying?
David just posted to our Facebook page, KOW Public Radio, quote, "The complete ignorance of so many white folks about explicit and implicit institutionalized racism is simply stunning."
There was a press conference just a little bit earlier today, and attorneys for Michael Brown's family and the Reverend Al Sharpton criticized St. Louis County Prosecutor Bob McCullough's decision to take the case in front of a grand jury and then not appoint a special prosecutor. But they also took protesters who committed violence to task during Tuesday's news conference, which took place earlier today. Just a little bit ago, Reverend Harriet Walden of Mothers for Police Accountability spoke to a crowd in front of the Mount Calvary Baptist Church in the Central District here in Seattle.
"Well, we are calling on the Department of Justice to file charges in this case, and we're calling on peace because we know how to be peaceful. Because if we didn't know how to be peaceful, we wouldn't still be here. Don't let anybody tell us that we're not peaceful people. Are we all fired up?
Yeah!
Are we ready to go?
Yeah!
All right, thank you."
And the group plans to march from 23rd and Union to the federal courthouse downtown, the march being organized by the Seattle King County NAACP chapter and United Black Clergy. The theme, "Change Won't Happen Unless We Make It Happen." KUOW's Liz Jones is on the scene. Liz, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Ross.
What's happening right now with this march?
Well, the march so far is going down Union toward downtown Seattle. They've reached about 12th Street here, and they've got a police escort about two blocks out ahead, kind of blocking traffic, rerouting traffic. I'm going to guess this march stretches on probably two blocks with people filling the middle of the street here. And where it started back at 23rd and Union, there was kind of an interesting merger of people who gathered in front of the church ready to protest and march, and a whole stream of Garfield students walking from several blocks away to kind of meet them in the middle of the intersection there. The marchers are walking down the street, chanting no justice, no peace, shouting hands up, don't shoot, shouting black lives don't matter. Or, black lives do matter.
What's the mood? How would you describe it? Angry, determined? What's the feeling?
Well, we heard a lot of the clergy address the crowd before the march got underway, really calling for a calm and peaceful protest here. And I've seen a lot of people in the crowd really trying to respect and honor that. They're walking with their hands up and kind of joining in solidarity here. You can tell there's some tension in the crowd. There are people who are angry, people who are sad, people still processing a lot of feelings after this verdict last night. But overall, there's a lot of energy in the air, people really wanting to see something change here.
Liz Jones, thank you very much. Liz Jones with protesters in Seattle marching from the Central District to the federal courthouse downtown, where it's a special edition of The Record. We're talking about Seattle's reflections on what happened in Ferguson and what happened with the grand jury. Could it happen here? Has it happened here? We're at 206-543-5869 or toll-free long distance 1-800-289-5869. You can write to us, record@kuow.org. We've got Max on the line calling from Seattle. Max, thanks for taking the time to give us a call today. What are your thoughts on the events of the since last evening?
Well, I don't think any of us are surprised. As a friend of mine who's a longtime anti-racist educator in Seattle said last night, racist systems can only produce racist results. And I think that's what we're seeing in this case. Police are killing young black people all across this country at a rate that's just astounding, and it just shows that the police are an institution that came out of slave patrols, so it's no surprise that this legacy of racism has continued and it's killing people even today.
What do you think can come out of this in a productive way to change?
Well, I think we need to see community organizing. We need to see people working to dismantle racist institutions and rebuild institutions that
I think we just lost that phone call. I'm sorry. Give us a call right back, and we will get you back on the line, gathering your thoughts on what it means and what it means for black America, what it means for white America. Sometimes there are very different reactions. You heard them reflected in some of the phone calls that we heard just a little bit earlier. And with me, Bon Huberman, who's our social media producer, who's been checking out what the reaction has been on social media. What are you reading there, Bon?
Well, Jonathan posted to our Facebook page. This is kind of coming from a different angle. He says, cops go to work with the sole intention of getting through another day alive. Without seeing the evidence, no one should judge this officer. Don't forget whose job it is to run into those buildings on 9/11, etc. Don't forget who stands between you and violent protesters destroying that city without regard.
This story began at noon on August 9th. Officer Darren Wilson shot and killed Brown, who was unarmed, in the middle of the street after a scuffle. Brown's body lay there for hours as police investigated and an angry crowd of onlookers gathered. Several days of tense protest took place in the predominantly black community, prompting Missouri Governor Jay Nixon to call in the National Guard. And McCullough decided to present the case to a grand jury, and their decision last night not to go ahead with the prosecution is what has sparked the latest round. Last night, President Obama spoke to the nation moments after the Ferguson decision came down.
First and foremost, we are a nation built on the rule of law. And so we need to accept that this decision was the grand jury's to make. There are Americans who agree with it, and there are Americans who are deeply disappointed, even angry. It's an understandable reaction. But I join Michael's parents in asking anyone who protests this decision to do so peacefully.
President Obama acknowledged that there is a larger message for the nation from what happened in Ferguson.
We need to recognize that the situation in Ferguson speaks to broader challenges that we still face as a nation. The fact is, in too many parts of this country, a deep distrust exists between law enforcement and communities of color. Some of this is the result of the legacy of racial discrimination in this country. And this is tragic because nobody needs good policing more than poor communities with higher crime rates.
the president with a couple of deep thoughts there. One about the distrust between law enforcement and communities of color. We'd welcome your thoughts on that. 206-543-5869. Also, he talked about those communities often as being the communities most in need of protection from police, so the importance of that cooperation. We're taking your phone calls and your thoughts on the meaning of Ferguson, both there and across the country and here in Seattle. We're at 206-543-5869. It's toll-free long distance, 1-800-289-5869, or you can write to us. It's record at kuow.org. Let's go down to Tacoma, where we've got Luke on the line. Luke, thanks for giving us a call. What are your thoughts today about the decision from the grand jury and the events which have been taking place over the last 24 hours?
Yes, I think it's obviously a very tragic event, and I realize why people would be so upset about it. I feel that the decision, obviously I wasn't there, but you know, I feel differently about it. But the point I wanted to raise, especially about the distrust between the law enforcement community and the community that they're policing, is that you know, when incidents like this happen, we never actually get to communicate directly with the police officer as a society. We don't see him standing and giving an address to the public, apologizing or, you know, addressing the situation in any way. And I think that creates a distrust, because then we never get to see the police officer as a human or as a actual person and bring them down to the level that we can relate to, whereas the victim is always very much, you know, the family is interviewed. There's a backstory on the individual. That's a very personalized perspective on the victim, but whereas the cop is very shielded from either, you know, being able to put things into his own words, which honestly could probably calm down the situation much more by allowing him to address the community directly, and it would actually put a face to the name there.
So you would actually like to hear that police officer speak to the public, or police officers involved in these incidents say something directly to the public?
Yeah, and I think there's a trend where that never happens. Yeah. It never takes place. And in the case of Ferguson, you know, even if he said, "Hey, look, I was terrified. I thought this guy was going to come after me. I pulled my weapon, and I'm terribly sorry about it. I think it's, you know, it was something I had to do as a reaction. I feel horrible, but it's just what I did.
Yeah.
And I, you know, it's what I did in my own self-interest to protect myself." I think that would either, you know, I think that would offer some sort of explanation on a personal level to the community of what his decision making was, why he acted that way. I think that if nothing else, that would add a little bit of closure to the situation.
Luke, thanks a lot for your phone call. You're listening to The Record on KUOW, and Seattle Reacts to Ferguson is our theme today. We're taking your phone calls at 206-543-5869, 1-800-289-5869. This isn't quite what Luke was talking about, but since the grand jury proceedings have been released, you can go and you can read the entire transcript to hear what that police officer said occurred, what his version of the events taking place on the street was. It's not him addressing the public directly, but it was his public statement to the grand jury. Let's go down to Gig Harbor, and we're joined in Gig Harbor by Sandra. Sandra, I understand you're married to a police officer.
Yes, I am.
And so what is your perspective on hearing all this?
Two officer-involved shooting.
Yes.
And they are very difficult, both. He's never, fortunately, had to take anyone's life. However, my concern about all of this is that everyone is referring to this young man that was, unfortunately, his life was ended. But it's the problem is that he was not... He was armed with his fists. Things that are not being said in the media are that this officer suffered a shatter fracture to his eye socket from this young man's fist.
And you think that that side of the story has not been coming out when you just see protesters upset about the death?
And the thing is that I am very sorry that this young man lost his life. I'm sorry he made the choices that he made that resulted in him losing his life. But if you assault a police officer and you attempt to take his weapon, the police officer has no choice, because you know what? At the end of the day, I expect my husband to come home to us. He didn't do anything wrong. He is going out and putting his life on the line for the community. And this young man, regardless of his race, made a decision that day to disrespect law enforcement, to disrespect the life of that police officer, and he paid the ultimate price for his decision.
Sandra, thank you so much for calling. I really appreciate it. And we're at 206-543-5869. Perhaps you're someone who is in law enforcement or connected to law enforcement and has a perspective on this. Many different ways of looking at it, and they really reveal this is a litmus test in many ways, how one reacts to this story. It really reveals a lot about our attitudes about race, about the police, about culture. We're at 206-543-5869. Bond Huberman is by my side, and she has been monitoring the social media response to this. Bond, what are you seeing?
I'm seeing a lot of different comments. A lot of it adds up to a sense of sadness among our audience in particular. Amy wrote on our Facebook page today, "I haven't seen anything, but I'm heartbroken. I ache for Michael Brown's family and their grievous loss. I'm sad for the officer who has to live with this for the rest of his life and probably fears for his own life."
Let's go to Robert, who's calling us today from Seattle. Robert, good afternoon. Thank you for calling The Record today. What are your thoughts?
Hi, Ross. How are you?
Good, thank you.
The reason I was calling was I love your show, and I wanted to comment on this. That I think one of the big mistakes they made, I was in the Rodney King riots back in Los Angeles, and even though I'm a white guy, you know, I was down in South Central with my friends on that day. And one of the mistakes that they made was in this grand jury trial, we don't have any of the facts or the information that they have upon which they made a decision.
But I think, Robert, actually, after the press conference last night, that was all released. There are a number of websites today that have links to the entire proceedings of the grand jury. You can read all the testimony.
Oh, that's terrific. And the other thing that I thought was kind of strange was, from what I read, if there were 9 people who voted in one particular direction, that 9 out of 12 would cement the decision.
Yes, I was curious about that, too. In fact, a reporter yelled out at the press conference, or someone in the audience asked the prosecutor what was the tally, and I never really heard an answer to that. We didn't really find out whether the grand jury was united or divided on this decision not to go ahead and prosecute.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah. Hey, Robert, thanks a lot for your phone call. I really appreciate it. You're listening to The Record on KUOW, and we're doing a special Seattle Reacts to Ferguson. Coming up, we're going to hear what the mayor had to say last night. We're going to hear from an incoming state senator on what might happen in Olympia as a result of this. And we're also going to find out more about the process of grand juries and how the grand jury may have come to this decision. This is The Record on KUOW. I'm Ross Reynolds. I'm Ross Reynolds with Bond Huberman, our social media director, and we're talking today about Seattle's reaction to what went on in Ferguson, something which really has affected the entire country. Missouri Governor Jay Nixon has ordered additional members of the National Guard to Ferguson. There were violent protests last night after the grand jury's decision not to indict Officer Darren Wilson. Nixon's office announced today that the additional guardsmen will provide security at the Ferguson Police Department, which was at the center of the protests late Monday and early today. The governor says he met today with the guard and law enforcement leaders to discuss how the troops will be used. He did not elaborate. Wilson shot and killed 18-year-old Michael Brown on August 9th, and the grand jury decision has led to protests in the area. Mayor Ed Murray addressed the public at a press conference last night about these events.
My message to young people in Seattle tonight, and particularly to African-American young people, while we do not have the answers, we in this city are listening to you. We in this city hear you. We in this city love you. In this hour of pain, your city is absolutely committed to moving forward so that together we can bring a greater sense of justice.
Also speaking last night, State Senator-elect and National Immigration Reform Leader Pramila Jayapal.
Back in 1948, Hubert Humphrey addressed the Democratic National Convention, and he said, "There are those who say we're rushing this issue of civil rights. I say we're 172 years late. Today, we're 238 years late and more. Enough is enough. We can't tolerate a corrupted system anymore that assaults anyone's safety and rights or dignity."
And Senator-elect Jayapal joins us today in the studio. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me here, Ross.
I was just listening to that comment you made last night and reflecting, there's a play on at the Seattle Rep about Lyndon Johnson mm-hmm. and the struggles over the civil rights movements of the 1960s. And from your comment there, it sounds as though you're saying we have a long way to go. Is there some message or some action item to draw from this horrible tragedy in Ferguson?
Well, I think there are several things. One, I think that, you know, people's reactions and the fact that almost everybody I talked to actually knew what the verdict was going to be before the verdict came down. I think that's a very telling statement about where people see the state of the justice system today. I think, secondly, if you look at this decision and the reactions to it, the reactions are not about just this decision. Obviously, that's the spark, but it is a history of embedded and institutionalized racism that has permeated all of our government systems. And the lack of trust that people feel between the police department and the public, which we saw right here in Seattle with the Department of Justice coming in with our consent decree, we are no Ferguson, but we have a lot of issues around that. And then I think the third thing is people are trying to figure out how you actually heal and move forward and actually create change in the context of a system that has felt like it hasn't changed for a very long time. So I think those are the three things that we're struggling with. I don't know that there are, you know, answers for every single one of them.
The system of justice, a justice of made up of laws made by lawmakers, which you will soon be.
Yes.
Is there anything in your mind as you go forward in the legislature to think that this is a reform that we need to make the justice system more attentive to these issues?
Well, I think that there are a few things. One is, you know, just looking at the very specific ways in which police departments use equipment. Those are sort of natural things that would come out of this. What is the list of militarized equipment that we have in the state of Washington and how are police departments using it? The Seattle Police Department put out a list right after that whole Ferguson event happened. But I think that the bigger questions are actually the harder ones. Education. How do we actually invest in young people and particularly young black men who are right now failing out of our public schools in Seattle at the rate of 52%? How do we actually get jobs for black men? How do we break the school to prison pipeline? So those are bills that are going to require a lot of attention, a lot of building of relationships across the aisle to get people to understand that we have to address these things up front, not wait for a Ferguson to happen.
As the president said, this is an issue in part of police trust with the community and how that trust has often been broken. And, you know, as I was thinking about the program today, I was thinking, could it happen here? And then I realized in a way it kind of did happen here back in 2010 with the Seattle police officer Ian Burke shooting and killing John T. Williams. That incident, among others, leading to the Justice Department's investigation into the Seattle Police Department's use of force policy. Now there's a consent agreement between the U.S. Justice Department and the city of Seattle designed to deal with that excessive use of force. Do you think in any way that has led to change in attitudes toward the police? Or is it too soon to tell? What do you think?
I think it's too soon, but I do think that the whole process of having the Department of Justice come in, validating the issues that people have been feeling for a very long time, having Chief O'Toole come in and the mayor committed along with the police department to a new vision, a new set of training, a new set of rules that they actually work on the streets with around biased policing, that all is part of the rebuilding process. But I think that, you know, we could, again, there were reports about Seattle becoming one of the whitest cities in the country. And I think we have to be very careful in the city of Seattle that we do not set up a dynamic where all of the people of color are pushed out of the city, that Seattle, in fact, stays sort of homogenous in one way, and that we create this division, both geographically, culturally, racially, that leads to the kind of tensions, both in terms of income inequality and racial equality. And those are very connected.
That's a really good point. And it's noted that many police officers in Seattle do not live in Seattle. There are some places in the country that require police officers to live in the areas where they are doing their work. What do you think about that?
Well, I think that we should have police officers living in the areas. And I also think that this idea of reflective democracy, which really came out in Ferguson, you have an almost all black town represented by almost all white legislators. And going into the Senate, where there are, I will be one of five people of color in the state Senate, the only woman of color in the state Senate. I think these are issues that we have to look at ahead of time. We cannot expect that people feel like the laws that are made are fair laws if they don't see themselves represented in the lawmakers. And the law that exists in Ferguson, you know, there are a lot of discussion about whether Darren Wilson followed the law. And the decision that there's no case to move forward relies on the idea that that law exists and is fair. But is it actually fair that a police officer should be able to shoot somebody? What investigation have we done around the other methods that should be used before a police officer decides that they're in fear? And by the way, the racial bias that's been proved, there are racial bias tests that have come out of Harvard University that show how people respond to people of color and young black men in particular, or black men in particular. If those are playing into a police officer's decisions when they're making the determination about whether or not it's fair to be afraid in that moment, how do we address those things? That is racial bias that's deeply entrenched.
Senator-elect Pramila Jayapal, thank you so much for coming in. We'll have to talk to you about your legislative agenda, too, coming
up. Thank you.
You know, that point we'll be addressing a little bit later on as we find out about what exactly the grand jury was asked to consider when it comes to filing charges against a police officer. And it's a very high bar. We're going to learn a lot more about that. Today, Seattle Reacts to Ferguson. We're at 206-543-5869. If you'd like to give us a call and share your thoughts, since the grand jury's decision last night, we've been asking for that. Lauren in Seattle called us just a little while ago with hers.
I'm basically right now on my way to the Cavalry Church to bear witness to Michael Brown's killing and the unjust decision with the grand jury. I'm really, as a white person, outraged at what's happening in this country, and I am doing everything to make some positive change for Trayvon Martin, for Eric Garner, for Michael Brown, for all the innocent lives that have been taken away. Black lives matter.
Later this hour, we'll hear from one of the organizers of the protest that started at Mount Calvary Baptist Church at noon, and we want to hear from you. Maybe you're part of that march. And you're listening to the radio, give us a call and tell us what's going on. Maybe you're someone who's about to go on duty at the Seattle Police Department or the Tacoma Police Department or another police department. What are your thoughts on what happened in Ferguson and what kind of influence that's going to have on us? We're at 206-543-5869, 800-289-5869. You can write to us, record@kuow.org. And Bon Huberman, our social media producer, is here. How can people reach us through social media?
They can tweet at KUOW or use hashtag KUOW Record, or they can write to us on our Facebook page, which is KUOW Public Radio.
What's jumping out at you right now, Bond, as you're taking a look at the social media reaction?
Well, just to kind of segue off of what the state senator-elect was saying, Rituja adds, "My morning was spent having a conversation with my 11-year-old on what racism is and why we all need to stand up against the injustices of the world."
Thanks very much. And we're going to get back to more of your social media reaction, and we're going to go back to the phone lines right now. We've got Nick from Renton who's given us a call to share his thoughts on the events. Nick, thank you for calling.
Well, thanks for taking my call.
It says here that you're an African-American former police officer.
Well, yes, I was not going to call. However, I would really like to hear from current African-American or white or Asian or Mexican-American police officers that are currently on duty. There's a side here that takes place when you're out there in front of people or when you're conducting your police work. Number one, you really don't talk to the press. Your captain or whoever your advisory is for your job, that's not your job to talk to the press. But there are emotions involved, and the officer can be afraid. He's a human being. And when you have a larger person coming at you, you have limited things that you can use to put down that threat or to keep things under control. If you don't do that, then it could spiral out of control. But the black officer especially is between two worlds, because surely in their family there's opinions, but there's the law and there's what actually can happen as a result of you pulling your weapon. Unfortunately, I was an officer in the Midwest, and believe me, the Midwest, Missouri, and those areas are still thinking, as far as their administration, police departments, government, prosecutors, to my feeling, they're still in 1965. I hate to go back that far, but I believe that's where they are. And those few officers that I know who are in the Midwest and in a small town right outside of Missouri where the action is now, they report that truly there's a disconnect. There has been no effort for the community leaders to reach out and talk to, A, the community, and B, put those people together with the officers and the people making those demands and those decisions.
Nick, I can totally appreciate the sort of conflict you might feel as a former police officer, as an African American. What about this decision? As you know, a lot of people are saying the decision not to prosecute was a bad decision. They think this just should have gone ahead based on what they knew of the case. What do you think?
Well, first of all, we don't know what we don't know.
Right.
And there's so many things that were shrouded. And a lot of the people are educated enough, even those people that may be hooligans that want to make trouble. There's some people always there that would love to have conflict and break-ins and what have you. But there's a group of enough people, middle-class, older people that are there that can control the rest of the community if you simply know all the facts. So I was amazed that the information was withheld. The information that was put out for the public is scanty. People don't understand how the justice system works there in the Midwest, and believe me, quite different.
Well, that's a really important point, and I did not have time today, but I know that there are links now to go through and read the entire proceedings of this court to find out what was presented to the grand jury. We heard the prosecutor last night speaking at length about the only people who knew the whole story were the jury, and now anyone can go and read all of that testimony, including from the officer, to kind of make up their own mind about what the events were, not relying on secondhand reports. Nick, thank you very much for your phone call. I really appreciate you calling in today. This is KUOW, Seattle. This is The Record on KUOW. I'm Ross Reynolds. The grand jury decided not to return an indictment against Darren Wilson, the cop who shot unarmed teenager Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri. Grand juries almost always return indictments. In fact, they do so 99.99% of the time. That's except when they involve police officers. We tried to get King County Prosecutor Dan Satterberg to explain this discrepancy. He did not pursue charges against a Seattle police officer who killed a homeless man back in 2010. Dan Satterberg was unavailable today. We've got University of Pittsburgh law professor David Harris on the line. He's written extensively on police misconduct and accountability. David Harris, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Good to be with you.
Why do most grand juries return indictments, but grand juries almost never indict police officers in shooting cases?
Well, to indict and then convict a police officer is a very, very difficult thing, and most prosecutors are not eager to do it. Here's why it's difficult. Number one, police, unlike civilians, actually have the privilege and the right to use force in order to do their jobs. They have the right to use the amount of force that is reasonable under the circumstances, and that can sometimes include deadly force. So from the get-go, you don't face the same kind of question. With a civilian, it would be who shot and why and what were the circumstances. With a police officer, of course you look at that, but also was the police officer justified in using the amount of force that he or she did? That adds a whole level of complexity. Beyond that, when a police officer is charged and brought into court, it is a difficult thing for any jury to do because the jury will have the idea that police officers are usually the good guys, and they usually are. And here we're facing a world, the jury sees, in which the police officer is in the defendant's chair. And a lot of times it's very hard for them to make that sort of subtle mental adjustment, even when the case is not very subtle and it's quite strong. Beyond that, police officers make very good witnesses, and often the people who serve as witnesses against them maybe have checkered pasts, they may have criminal records. They, in any event, are probably not the kind of testifying repeaters or professionals that police officers are. So all of those factors make it very hard to prove a case and to have charges against a police officer. And that means that in most cases that the United States Department of Justice, for instance, investigates of police violence, they actually charge a very, very small fraction of police officers investigated with a crime. It is really one of the most difficult kinds of cases to prove in the American legal system.
David Harris, as I understand it, prosecutors usually ask for a particular charge when they present a case to a grand jury. But in the case of Darren Wilson and the Michael Brown case, the prosecutor did not do that. Is that unusual?
Oh, there were so many things that were unusual about the way this grand jury was handled. Usually, it is fair to say that grand jury is run by the prosecutor. You know, there's a judge who's nominally in charge, but the judge isn't there. The prosecutor runs it. The prosecutor decides what evidence goes in front of the grand jury, which witnesses testify. The prosecutor effectively builds a case for probable cause for a charge in front of the grand jury by the way that he or she handles the grand jury, and always, but always, makes a recommendation on what charges the prosecution wants the grand jury to vote on and why they should vote. So here we had a highly unusual situation. Not only did the prosecutor not recommend any particular charges in the end, we knew from the beginning that this prosecutor kind of said, well, look, I'm just going to give them every piece of evidence, all the evidence, all the witnesses, and they can decide, and kind of abdicated his control and minimized his role. Now, that's not illegal, but it is so unusual, such a deviation from what prosecutors usually do, that it really sent a strong signal to me and to other people who know this stuff that the prosecutor was effectively building himself some political cover. If the grand jury were to come back with no indictment, he'd say, well, it's not me, that's the grand jury. If they come back with an indictment, I can't do anything about that, that's the grand jury. But he knew also that because he was not steering the grand jury in the usual way, it would make it less likely that they would come back with an indictment.
Does the fact that Darren Wilson was not indicted mean that he's innocent?
No, it doesn't. What the grand jury determines is whether there is probable cause to go forward with a trial. And probable cause is a very low standard of evidence. The grand jury is determining whether or not there is enough evidence for a trial to go forward. That's all it determines. It does not determine guilt or innocence. We will never know what would happen in a trial if a regular jury were to hear all these witnesses, see all the evidence, what decision they would make. It may be something else entirely.
David Harris, thank you very much for your time.
My pleasure.
David Harris is a University of Pittsburgh law professor. He's written extensively on police misconduct and accountability. And the lack of action in Ferguson doesn't mean there won't be more legal action. Sometimes in these cases, the federal government steps in and puts forward a civil rights prosecution if they feel as though what happened at the local level wasn't sufficient. And there is some investigation of doing that now. Last night, a couple hundred people marched through Seattle to protest the grand jury's decision. But others took a different tack. At Garfield Community Center, concerned citizens gathered to voice their frustration. KUOW's Ruby DeLuna was there, and she has this report.
The public meeting was designed as an alternative to the street protests. Reverend Harriet Walden of Mothers for Police Accountability came up with the idea as part of a rapid response plan for the city. She says she wanted to give young people a safe place to express themselves in a more constructive way.
The young people get caught up in the moment, and everybody out there is not for their best good. It's not. I mean, there's a lot of provocateurs out there. We've been around for 25 years. We've never broken a window, and we've never gone to jail. So there is another way of organizing, and we'd like to introduce that.
Similar meetings were held in other Seattle neighborhoods. Police were also invited to take part and to answer questions from the public. Mariah Marshall came with her son to watch the announcement on TV.
He's 10, and he's going to be a black man one day. And to me, it's like it's a danger being a black man just because of all these things that are happening. So I'm looking at my son, and I want him to be aware.
Marshall says she's baffled by the Ferguson jury's decision, and she wasn't alone. At the meeting, people voiced their sadness, anger, and disappointment. But the meeting was also a forum for hope. There were young people in attendance, some of them 7th and 8th graders. They envisioned a community where the people value equality, people who are loving and caring toward each other. One young girl challenged the adults to lead by example because, she said, we're looking up to you guys. I'm Ruby DeLuna, KUOW News.
You know, one thing that stuck out from that report, Harriet and Walton from Mothers for Police Accountability, saying there are a lot of provocateurs out there. Do you think some are taking advantage of the passions in this situation? We're at Seattle reacting to Ferguson. We're at 206-543-5869. This is The Record. It's The Record on KUOW. Seattle reacts to Ferguson is our theme today. As we've been speaking, a protest march has been moving from the Central District to downtown Seattle, organized by the Seattle King County NAACP and the United Black Clergy. After a meeting at noon at the Mount Calvary Baptist Church on 23rd and Union, they've gotten to the federal courthouse downtown. They're at 7th and Stewart right now. We're joined by organizer K.L. Shannon, a community organizer with the NAACP. K.L., thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, how you doing today?
Good. Could you describe the scene there right now?
Well, I would say there's about 600-700. Yep. Okay. There's about 600-700, mostly young people out here. Very diverse crowd, chanting Black Lives Matter. Hands up, don't shoot. So it's a very loud crowd right now.
KL, have you been talking at all about beyond demonstrating your feelings about this, how this might coalesce into some action? Is there something you'd like to see happen in Seattle? We've got the state legislature convening in next month. Is there some concrete action you'd like to see come out of this?
So, we're very clear about what we want. We want federal charges against Darren Wilson, this officer. We want federal charges against him. We want the DOJ to investigate. We want, support for the Brown family. So, this is not going to be over until justice has been served for the Brown family.
K.L. Shannon, what's your sense of the mood? I mean, there were some arrests in Seattle last night. Last night in Ferguson, there was some rioting and some looting. How do you gauge the temperature of people upset about this?
Well, people are very upset. I think that's why there's so many people out here today. They're hurt, they're frustrated, they're angry. And they're out here to show not only Seattle but the world that, we stand with the Brown family around the country. So there hasn't been any arrests here. People have been very peaceful, and that's what we asked for in the beginning of this march and rally. This is a peaceful rally and march. So we are here to demand justice for the Brown family, for the death of Michael Brown, and we're not going to stop until justice is served.
K.L. Shannon, thank you so much for your time. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
This is The Record on KUOW, 206-543-5869. Mike has been patiently waiting on the line to weigh in today. Mike, thanks for giving us a call. What are your thoughts about the Ferguson events?
Yeah, well, I just wanted to point out from a parent's point of view, I lost my juvenile daughter in a random close-up murder that was racially motivated.
I'm very sorry to hear that.
And she laid on the pavement for hours in her blood. I just want to bring it back to the point that there are parents that have lost their child, and there's brothers and sisters that have lost their sibling. And that's a huge tragedy. And then, especially when you're in the public eye with these kind of things, everyone else wants to pile their issues and their attitudes toward, and as your previous person talked about, the provocateurs. They pile on and they add to your tragedy. And even KUOW on this story, when you guys first were reporting this story, you reported it as a white police officer shoots an unarmed Black man. And right there, you've made it excessive use of force and racial. And when you don't even know. And I guess my point is that all these people just pile on, and the same as the guy who breaks the plate glass window and loots the big screen TV. All these people are like that. Al Sharpton is like that. He's there, and he's basically promoting himself and his cause on the backs of this family's tragedy. He's a looter.
Mike.
And so many people related to these things are. And in the end, it's, this family has this tragedy, and they're asking people just to stop.
And the depth of the tragedy there is alone to bear. Mike, thanks very much for your phone call. I appreciate it. Bonnie Huberman, who's our social media producer, has been checking what people have been writing on social media about this. Bond, what do you see?
Joshua just posted to our Facebook page, "I believe in the saying that the arc of the moral universe is long, but bends towards justice. So some good will be organized from all this grief."
A quote that the president used, I believe, in his inaugural address. Yeah. It's 5 minutes to 1 o'clock on the record. Let's go to Matt, who's listening to us today in Seattle as we're gathering your reactions to the events in Ferguson. Matt, thanks for taking the time. Matt, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Yes. What are your thoughts on what we've heard and seen from Ferguson and here in Seattle?
There's just two main things I'll try to make real quick, because I know you've got a lot of people. When I wanted to address the mayor's statements, because I was actually going through a case, it stopped legal lynching, .wordpress.com, but going through a case where the police, for cop watching, which is videotaping the cops, had like 30 people like attack me on video and everything. And then when we confronted the mayor about it after my court case, which I was found guilty of having like a knife to defend myself, which was illegal, when we went there and did the demand delivery, he just wrote it off and like brushed it off. There were like 40 people there, a community, like, "You need to take this seriously." And he's like, "Oh, but I did all these policies," and that's it. Mm-hmm. And so as he like says a whole bunch of stuff, like he's in support of Black Lives, but obviously when people literally asked him, "Do Black Lives Matter?" he wouldn't answer it. He wanted to divert to like, "Oh, I've done all these policies."
Right.
And that was like showing where Seattle's line is. I do want to also touch, because I was at the march last night.
Yes.
I want to touch on what people are saying about provocateurs. The only provocateurs that were the police. They were hitting people with rubber bullets, using flashbangs, and attacking people for trying to like stand up for what has happened to the not just Mike Brown, but all the Black lives, including the 12-year-old who just died 2 days ago, shot by the police.
Another tragic incident. Matt, thank you very much for calling. I appreciate it. And send us more information about what it is that you're talking about so we can take a closer look into it. We have Liz Jones back with us, Liz Jones, KUOW reporter, who's been covering that march. We just talked to KL, who is one of the organizers of it. And Liz, what's happening right now at the march?
The march has almost reached the federal building downtown. They're probably about four blocks away here. The organizers have been trying to keep kind of slow things down because there's a lot of energy in this crowd that's kind of pushing and moving forward. And a lot of mixed emotion. People saying they feel hope, seeing a lot of youth turn out for this march downtown today. A lot of the Garfield students from Garfield High School came out, so that's making people feel hopeful. But also a lot of people feeling worried about the verdict they saw in Missouri last night, and wondering where we're headed on in race in this country. I talked to one 28-year-old Black man who said, you know, he lives in fear for the younger children, not so much for himself. He said he's lived a full life at 28, but he fears for the younger ones who haven't gotten that far in life yet.
I don't know what to do with that. If he feels as though he's lived a full life at 28, one would hope that people in America would think they could live a much longer life, free of fear and free of violence.
Right. We see a lot of families out here today, mothers who have kids that they worry about. But I think the prevailing feeling I've been hearing out here is people kind of feeling some hope, seeing people come together, and especially seeing youth turn out. I've heard that repeatedly here, seeing kids turn out, that they're the ones who can really take a hold and change this.
Well, getting a conversation started is at least the beginning of a beginning. Liz Jones, thank you so much. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Ross.
And you'll hear Liz's full report later on today on KUOW. Bond Huberman, social media, last couple of words from folks who have been getting in touch with us via social media.
I'll share one more from Nikki, who posted to our Facebook page. "My father is a firefighter. If his only concern is coming out of a fire alive, then he would be a horrible firefighter. His job is to protect the community."
Bond, great having you here.
Thank you.
Don't be a stranger. Come back again. The record, produced by Amina Alsadi, Andy Hurst, Hannah Byrne, and Jeannie Yandel. Kava Anderson, Matthew Strive, and Posey Gruner. Jim Gates is our editor. Our production assistant, Brianna Ripley. The dapper, Bernard Ouellette, is our engineer. David Hyde's our executive producer. I'm Ross Reynolds. This has been The Record for Tuesday, November 25th, 2014.